We're going to start with the Shir of the Haggadah, and I must say, this is, God willing, very excited, our first Pesach in Eretz Yisrael.
Yay!
And don't all cheer at once.
How am I
going to
do
this? Yeah, this is the. Everybody gets upset at the first Pesach Shir of the year because now it's real. Like, if we're really talking about Pesach, then, you know, it really must be coming. But as much as you all, and this is why this is very good, as much as you all are frantic about preparing from a physical perspective, it's so important to also prepare from a spiritual perspective, because I can't tell you how many people. You know, you ask them how their Seder was, and the women, by and large, especially, even the men, to be honest with you, if they hadn't spent time preparing for the Seder, then it just kind of passes you by, and it doesn't become the experience that you want it to be. So it's important not just to clean and cook, but also to spend time learning and preparing and thinking about the Seder. So hopefully, the time that we have here is just going to be an impetus and a spur to spur you on to, while you're scrubbing God only knows what, to also be thinking about the Seder as well and thinking about the themes of Pesach, which I think are important and valuable, and I'm quite confident that the time you spend studying about the Seder will pay off in dividends as well, and also give you ideas to make the Seder experience that much more meaningful for your families and for your children. I'm going to share with you just the personal thoughts about the Seder, especially as our first in Eretz Yisrael. And it's like, the Seder is a very, very interesting experience, because on the one hand, we're supposed to be free, you know, and especially in America, or wherever you were coming from, or South Africa, or England, or all that, that the notion of freedom is a very interesting one, because we're neither here nor there in a very real way. You know, we're not avadim, but on the other hand, are we b'nei chorin? Can we really say we're b'nei chorin? And, you know, in Eretz Yisrael, we're going to talk about this idea of what were the expectations if we would be celebrating a Seder in Eretz Yisrael. What were Chazal's expectations? And what do we do with the fact that they are not met? You know, we're not really there yet. And how do we deal with that? So just by way of introduction, I'll start. You know, we're gonna study today Halach Ma'anya, which is the first part of Magid, and we'll see some very interesting themes of the Haggadah from Halach Ma'anya. But I'm gonna start just by way of discussion. I got a call from a person recently. So obviously, one of the things that people know about me is that I'm a rabbi. I was a shul rabbi who made aliyah and left my community, my pulpit. And that's not an easy thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to do. And so now I'm starting to get calls from other rabbis who also are considering leaving their pulpits and making aliyah. And it's certainly not an easy thing to do. And one of the things that rabbis say to me is, well, I know for a fact that since I'm an American rabbi, I'll never be able to communicate in Hebrew and with the same eloquence and the same communication skills that I could in English. And to be honest, that's true. And I'm sure that, you know, it might not just a problem for rabbis. One of the things that all of us as Olim struggle with is this notion of communication and language. And all of us, unless you're really like you grew up here and your Hebrew is amazing, all of us grew up with a different language, and to whatever degree, there's a sort of communication gap, there's a language gap that we struggle with. Is this just me, or those of you who are, you know, and that language gap, it gives you a sense of alienation that's very difficult to overcome. That there's always like some joke that the Israelis are telling that you don't really know, and it's about you, right?
It's not funny anyway.
I think that's a feeling of disempowerment.
Interesting that you're right. Yeah, I mean that you just sort of, you know, and you know, like your child comes home with some note, and it's in like, you know, a lot of Hebrew words, and you have to sort of like go to your neighbor to try to decipher what it is that they're trying to tell you. And I want to speak about it. It's very interesting because the notion of language, you call it language disempowerment, which I think is a very powerful thing. It speaks to a sense of alienation, which Chazal, which the rabbis wanted us to understand and appreciate in through the Haggadah. Remember, Haggadah is, you want to, be'avdut l'chirut. What is Pesach? From slavery to freedom. So one of the ways that you feel a sense, what's slavery? Slavery is, this is not your place, you don't belong, it's not, you're not here, and you're not where you're supposed to be. So there's a certain irony in the sense that the Haggadah was the ideal Haggadah, what is the ideal when you're supposed to speak the Haggadah? Where is it supposed to be ideally? When they're supposed to be telling the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim?
In Israel.
In Yerushalayim, correct. We're all Ola L'Regel, and we're sitting with our Korban Pesach, and we're telling Avdut L'Chei. We are free, but we're telling the story, we're going back and telling the story. So with that in mind, we begin the Hala Achma Anya. I'll read through it, I'll translate it, and then we'll begin to ask a number of different questions, and use it as a springboard in order to understand about the Pesach night itself. Okay, we start with Halach Ma'anya, Zi Achalu Avatana Be'ara Dimitzrayim. Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of Anya, Oni, affliction. We'll call it the bread of affliction, because that's how they translate it. But nobody knows what bread of affliction is, okay? Zi Achalu Avatana, that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Kol Dichvin Yeite V'yechol. Anyone who is Dichvin, needs, should come and should eat. Kol ditzrich, anyone who needs, yeite v'yisach, should come and pass over, celebrate the Pesach. Hashata hacha. This year, hashata now, hacha, we are here. L'shana haba'ah ba'ara di'Yisrael. Next year, in the land of Israel. I love reading that here.
Did you say it last year?
I did say it last year. What? You cried last year? Yeah. Hashata avde. This year we are slaves. L'shana haba'a b'nei chorin. Next year, we will be free. Okay, so let's start asking questions.
If the ideal Haggadah should be said when you are in Israel, why are you saying this year we're here and next year we'll be in Israel?
Okay, very good.
You mean like we'll still be in Israel, or maybe the ideal is not to be said in Israel?
Would you say that? The ideal is not to be said in Israel?
Maybe when the time Mashiach comes and all of B'nai, maybe like Hashata Hacha is this year we as a nation are here, meaning in Galut, or Eretz Yisrael, 1 minute, let me
percolate, yes, okay.
Okay. That maybe, I would assume that our Ad Israel is something that's ideal, our Ad Israel, that we are not now in Eretz Israel, but we would like to be in Eretz Israel, the ideological Eretz Israel.
Really?
I guess.
Clearly, you want to be somewhere else, and you have to be somewhere else ideologically, not physically, because you're physically where you're supposed to be.
You keep talking about the ideal Haggadah. Uh-huh. Ideal Haggadah, I'm pretty sure in Pesachim it talks about like that they made their little shawarma sandwich. That would be something that.
That's why, like, one of my favorite topics is the shawarma sandwich.
The shawarma sandwich, yeah. You know, and.
What do you mean by the shawarma sandwich? Yeah, can I just digress? I'll backtrack. What do you mean? It's great that you say it that way. Okay, when it says Hillel Hayak Korech Pesach Matzah Umarur Biyachad Ba'ochlam Behaseba. Right, we see that's korech. What does korech mean? What is a korech? What is a kricha in Hebrew? A kricha. No, what's a kricha?
Kricha.
Kricha is the binding. The binding of the cover.
Oh, karich, sorry. Karich is a sandwich?
Karich is a sandwich. In modern Hebrew.
Yeah, but it's also
in the modern.
What do we call it in what would we call that food if you went to a restaurant in...
Kricha is also, it's the binding of book.
Correct. We call it a wrap.
A wrap. Yes.
Okay. So this is, by the way, my favorite proof to say that show you that Hillel, for his bread, did not eat matzah the way we have it. What did he have?
It was the tamanini.
What?
The tamanini.
That's right, with tamanini. He clearly had eish tanur. Eish tanur. So but what would he put in his eish tanur? Pesach, which is what?
The lamb.
Lamb. Pesach on matzah and maror. What's maror? Kharif, exactly. Take an eish tanur, wrap it up with lamb.
Much more
appetizing. Oh, no, okay. It's great. That's unbelievable. I can now think about what the now think about when you have your korech of your hard matzah together with lettuce and it's all falling out. Now you understand what's missing. Yeah, go ahead. I digress.
Okay, so they said, you know, like the Avadim Hayim, they said certain parts which have come into our Haggadah. Haggadah is an evolution and was clearly written in Chutz La'aretz.
Ooh, so why do you say that? What? Clearly written in Chutz La'aretz?
Hashata Avde, Hashata. It's not in Hebrew.
Ah, excellent. So that's question number one. Question number one.
wasn't spoken in Israel, it was spoken
the majority
in
of the Hebrew. Just this was the opening paragraph.
It's a very good point. Let's ask it as a question. Because the first thing you notice that halach ma'anya was written first and foremost was written in Aramaic. What's right after Aramaic? What's right after this?
Manishtana.
Hebrew. Manishtane laila dain. You don't say, right? You know, of course, our children. Well, I don't know. You're supposed to like be cute and learn it in Yiddish. And do they do it in French? Your kids do it in French?
When I was in high school, like, we learned in third grade how to say it in Yiddish.
Yeah, of course, right.
My grandparents were like, but my grandparents didn't even speak such good Yiddish. But they were like, oh, our great grandparents would be rolling in their graves. And then we learned it in French class. We learned it in French.
We also learned it in French.
You learned it in French. Spanish class. In Spanish. Right. Okay. So you notice right away. That's what you first. You notice the question: why in the world is Manishtana in is Ha Lach Ma'anya in Aramaic when the rest of the Haggadah Kim'at, the rest of the Haggadah is in Hebrew? Excellent question. Question number one. That's question number two.
It's interesting. The beginning and the end of the Haggadah is in
Chagad.
Yeah, it's
really
Aramaic.
Oh, okay. Chagad. Yeah, it's a very. I mean, I never really studied Chagad. Yeah. Chagad is weird. It's just weird. It is. Okay. Right. Next question. Any other questions? Well, Rina asked a question. She didn't realize she was asking a question. Where was it written? Which is really, where was the rest of the Haggadah written? You know, if Halach Ma'anya is only in Aramaic, the only part and the rest of it is in Hebrew, what that indicates is either somebody did something intentionally or something else happened later on. Okay? What else you want to ask? Now let's talk about the text, the context, the substance of the Halach Ma'anya.
If I didn't know the story, then I would think that the Jews had been eating matzah the whole time.
Excellent. Halach Ma'anya di achalu avatana be'ara de Mitzrayim. This is the bread of affliction that our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. Did they? What in the world are we saying? So the first thing we start the Haggadah by saying something that's not true.
Assuming that it's the bread that Hillel ate, right? Pizza, lafak, yeah. Something that doesn't rise.
Sure.
That is what they were eating.
How do you know?
They were working. They didn't have time to make bread.
For lafak, because that's what the Egyptians ate.
What?
That's what they eat.
Egyptians eat lafak?
All these Middle Eastern countries, they put a fire, they put a thing, and they pat their bread down. They didn't make, like, big fancy rolls. That's a...
Yeah.
French thing.
That's tortillas in Mexico.
Now, prove to me from the Chumash that what you said is not true. From the Chumash. No, the fish they ate, but prove to me about the bread itself.
They say that they brought loaves of bread.
That's not what I was thinking of. Okay, but prove to me from
it
says when they left, lo yachlu lehit mameya. They couldn't have time to let them to rise.
But that's because they knew from the day before that they were going there, but they should have had.
That's not the shear we're going to discuss today, but that's another shear which is critical and very important. It's an excellent question. I'll give you an even better reason why it's a fallacy, because it says they didn't have time, they knew from before. But even before that, when they ate the Korban Pesach, what does it say that they had to eat the Korban Pesach with?
Matzah.
So this whole thing about v'lo yachlu lehit mameya, they're rushing out, they had matzah the night before.
Also, right. when they
but again, that's not the shiur we're going to discuss. Maybe next week. Okay.
When they complained after the splitting of the Red Sea and they complained and they got them on, their complaint was that they remember sitting in Mitzrayim, v'shivtenu al sir habasar, v'achlenu lechem lasova.
Lechem lasova. Well, matzah could also be lechem. We call that bread. We eat as much bread as we want. Okay, but it's clear that they had bread rise. How do you make normal bread? How do you make
yeast?
Right, they don't have quick rise yeast.
That's
exactly right. Right. Anyway, it's very
important.
What's that?
You make the yeast from the dough.
Either they don't have sourdough, but more commonly, what would you do if you don't have sourdough? Which is what's sourdough?
Sourdough.
Ah, okay. It's a very interesting. People don't really realize, like, especially now that we all have quick. like quick yeast. There was a quick rise yeast in your little packet. Most people, what is yeast? What is yeast?
Bacteria.
Fungus.
It's bacteria that becomes mixed with the dough, and over time, the bacteria causes a reaction, a chemical reaction, and it expands because it's mixed in with the dough. It causes a reaction, and the carbon dioxide that's emitted from as the bacteria eats whatever the food in the dough is, it expands and it causes the dough to rise, as it were. The air causes air pockets to rise in the dough. That's my chemical deduction of bread. Okay? This bacteria is found where?
In the dough itself.
Everywhere, it's in the air. Exactly. It's in the bacteria is in the air. If you don't have yeast, what? You're breathing it right now. If you don't have yeast, if you just made dough of bread and water and you covered it and you left it for long enough, it would eventually rise. Right. So there are two ways of doing that. One is to let your bread rise for like a period of 24 hours. With almost no yeast at all. Or another way is to make what's called sourdough. Sourdough is taking this mixture of yeast, of bacteria, and some kind of, how should we say this, like
food? Same idea, making milk into yogurt. You let it stand, it ferments, gets sour, and then
right.
When it eats on the carbs of the flour,
exactly.
It also...
Exactly. Now, the way you make sourdough is you have this mixture of sourdough, and you just keep feeding it. And it could last forever. Once when we were in Detroit, we were trying to see if we could make our restaurant kosher. They had this mixture of sourdough, this bakery, that they had used for 20 years. And they just kept feeding it, take a little bit off, feed it, and 20 years. They had the same sourdough.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really kind of nifty. And that's how you make real sourdough bread. It's
American thing.
What?
It's an American thing.
Is it? There's no sourdough bread? No, it's not. Fancy.
I'm sure in Irish food.
It's a fancy bread. It's a very, very fancy bread. What? They don't make sourdough bread? Yeah, I think it's a European thing. Go to the like bakery guy in Rami Levy and ask him if he makes sourdough bread, like real sourdough. Probably
when they talk about matzah, obviously they knew what matzah was. Right. So obviously they used to eat at one point. They ate matzah. It's not like the first.
Who? I mean, in Egypt.
In Egypt.
Right. What was matzah? Right. So what is matzah?
Crackers.
Unfermented dough, baked dough, without waiting. Right, that's what it says. V'lo yachlu lehitz mameh. I didn't have time to wait. But they didn't have time. They didn't have. By the way, how long did they wait between the time that they knew that they were leaving and then the time they left?
A day.
No. How many knew for sure that they were leaving and the time they left?
A month.
Yeah,
because they had a.
How long was it from the time they said let's go to the time they opened the door and left?
30 seconds.
Minutes.
No, so Moshe tells them to leave.
No, what do you mean? They take all their neighbors' golds and dishes, and then that
was from Choshech. But no, but they had to take the lamb to make Korban Pesach.
Right.
And they had to sit for a month. Next, they had to watch it for a month.
The Korban, no, that was only for they took it from Shabbat. I say it was 6 hours. Why was 6 hours? Correct, because they only knew that they were leaving after Makat B'chorot. Paro got up and said, "Get out." You know, they didn't know they were leaving until Paro said, "Get out." Okay, how long? But they couldn't leave. Why couldn't they leave? They were not permitted to leave until the next morning. Ish lo yitzu mipetach beito ad boker. So they spent that night sitting on shpilkas. They didn't leave.
Okay.
What?
Where did they eat
the in their homes.
The night before.
Right. In their homes.
The night before Paro said he could go?
Yes.
Before
they knew. The Korban Pesach, how they know? They didn't know until Paro said finally after Makat B'chorot. Right? Paro got up and he called and went around to Moshe in pajamas in the middle of the night.
But they would have left anyway.
Is that only an American thing or is that a South African thing also?
It's an Israeli thing too.
Right, okay, right.
They would have left irrespective of what he said.
Really?
Yes.
Well, why didn't they leave irrespective of what he said all along?
Because Moshe...
Take a look. Right? She's like, when did they say, right?
Well, they knew they were going to leave. They just didn't know when. No.
Because
everything ready, just kind of like, we're just waiting for Pharaoh to make up his mind. Let's go.
Oh, really?
I don't know.
Really? Really? Then why didn't they have bread? If I told you, you're leaving, right? You're leaving. I don't know. Think about this. Pack it up your whole house. Move into another country. Can you imagine such a thing? Would you make sandwiches?
Yeah.
Right. What do they have?
Nothing. What do they have?
What do they have with them?
Matzah.
Why? Why?
So you have enough time. Oh, okay.
Yeah, enough time for what? And this is always something I struggle with. Make? What do you mean to make? Moshe told them they were leaving.
I'm just thinking about something.
So it's they knew that they were leaving, so the question is still on the table?
My question.
The
eighth of Matzah, the Korban Pesach. The point is, when they ate the Matzah of the Korban Pesach, and for some reason, even though Moshe told them, oh, by the way, we're leaving, right? If Moshe told you you're leaving, you would have the suitcases at the door, but even more than the suitcases at the door, wouldn't you have like a care package and snacks for the kids, like all packed up and ready to go in a thermos? Wouldn't you?
In that way. So if you're packing up sandwiches, right, you know your sandwiches are going to last you maximum a day.
Yeah.
But the next day, they're not going to be good anymore.
Okay.
But matzah can last the whole week.
Okay.
Take a box of matzah and go camping, you've got your box.
Yeah, but pizza.
You don't have to worry about finding a
macaroni. Okay, but you're saying, oh, the matzah the matzah that we have, but not their pizza. Remember, their matzah. They didn't burn off the matzah. Nope, it's clear. Nobody in their right mind would eat the matzah we eat. That's nuts.
Maybe they needed to take matzah with them because it was what they needed for them. But there.
For the long road?
Whatever.
They ran out of food 3 days later anyway. You know what I'm saying? They ran out.
3 days.
Yeah. They had to make more. They clearly along the way had to stop, right, and bake more. Hold on. This is very fascinating. Let's go along and then we'll move on because I want to actually...
When they ate the Korban Pesach and they could only eat it with matzah and maror, were they at that stage instructed not to have any leaven in the house?
Yes.
So then therefore they couldn't have had any bread.
No, leaven means any bread left, but they could have had matzah. No, I see what you're saying. They had to get rid of all the chametz.
So then, after they'd eaten the korban, then the logical follow that after they'd eaten the korban pesach, there was no bread in the house, and then and then at that stage there wasn't enough time to bake bread.
Now, by the way, I want to point out as we're discussing this is a fascinating discussion, a very wonderful discussion about these things. This is the kind of discussion that you want to think about. How do I engender this discussion at my seder? How do I ask these questions and with your children, obviously, and get them to discuss this issue, you know what I'm saying? What really happened? What was it like? What were they doing? Where's the... Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, I'm enjoying it very much, but I want to point out to you that this is a wonderful... These are wonderful issues and questions that you can raise just from Halach Ma'anya. Did they really? You know, let's think about the time frame. When did they go out? You know, you understand what I'm saying? And think about that as you scrub your whatever. You know what I'm saying? About how to engender this kind of discussion. I'm sorry, but I digress. They didn't have any... You're saying they didn't have...
They didn't have any leaven then, and then they didn't have time after that to bake more.
Couldn't they, if you knew you were leaving then, and you couldn't have any leaven, so you would have unleavened?
Well, they had the mitzvah of chametz.
What I'm saying is...
To
eat it with the korban pesach. To eat it with the korban pesach.
They did.
Only matzah. I mean, do they have to get rid of... I don't know. Do they have to actually get rid of all the chametz from the house like we do? I can't imagine. I just don't know. Anyway, so now we ask our question. So that brings us back to the question: Halach ma'anya? Did they di'achalu avatana b'mitzrayim? But there's an even more basic question before we start answering all these fascinating questions. What's a more basic question? What is lach ma'anya? You all assume. What do you assume? What is lach ma'anya? Lechem oni.
Poor man's bread.
Okay. Why anya oni? Oni from Ani. But what is Oni? What does the word Oni mean?
Affliction,
torture. What is the bread of affliction that they ate in Egypt? Why do we call it, more importantly, why do we call it Lachma Anya? What is it called, Lachma Anya? Okay, so let me just review. I'll review my notes. One, why do we start in Aramaic? Question number one, why do we start in Aramaic? Well, before we get the answer, I just want to repeat the questions. Number two, why do we call it Lachma Anya, Lechem Oni? Why do we start in Aramaic, in a foreign language? Okay, number two, why do we call it Lechem Oni, Lachma Anya? Okay, number three, okay, did they really eat it in Egypt? De'achalu avatana be'arad Mitzrayim. What are we referring to when we say that they ate it in Egypt? What is it? What are we saying that they ate it in Egypt? Okay, and then the fourth question is my overall question. What are we supposed to be feeling when we say Lashana Haba, you know, B'nei Chorin? And you know, how are we supposed to react to it? I guess, and then the fifth question we ask, well, that's whatever, we'll leave that. Okay. Yes, somebody had something they wanted to interject, or you wanted to say something? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Maybe the Lach Ma'anya is not literal.
maybe it's not. Maybe it was like the bread of affliction. This is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate. So I know you're supposed to point to the mat or whatever, but maybe that was their way of describing what had happened to them.
Ah, very good.
Not literally, this is the bread, but this is the situation that we were in.
The bread that we ate when we were in affliction.
I would even say, I think bread is your basic livelihood. It's going down to your bottom level of basic food of livelihood. And this is their situation.
This was their self. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The lechem that they ate in Oni. That's what you're saying.
I wouldn't even take, I wouldn't even use the word lechem. I would even just, I mean, they say, but it's an analogy to their life.
Ooh, interesting.
Not literally the bread that they ate, but the...
Now, by the way, what do you do when you say ha lachma anya? You pick up the matzah and say ha. Ha means this is. Now, and it's very, it's, by the way, it's important to note that, and this is an important thing also, that you should really focus on as, and most of us, all of us have young children, well, again, you know, that we're focusing on when we're thinking about the Seder. The Seder, the rabbis wanted very much, and we'll see, it's designed for kids, and it has to be experiential. Ha, lachma, anya. This is that, you know, they say, pick it up, eat it, look at it, talk about it, and so then you should also think about, in more modern ways, how do we make the Seder an experiential time of experience for our children. And obviously the younger the children, the more young your Seder shall be. You know what I'm saying? You know, you want to make a little puppet show out of from Egypt? I say go for it, because the more meaningful it is, the more experiential it is, the better it is. And you see this throughout the Haggadah, like, you know, Chad Gadya. Take this crazy song about some stupid goat, and then wait till the end when everybody can bray like a goat. Great, because that's the point, is you want your children to experience. And the more you can enliven it, the better it off you'll be. Why do we call it Halachma Anya? Rina, if you will please open up my Tanakh to Devarim, Perek Tet Zayin Pasuk Gimel. Okay, will you please read for me Devarim, Perek Tet Zayin Pasuk Gimel. Good, so why do we call it Lechem Oni, Lachma Anya? Because that's what the Torah calls it. Okay, Lechem Oni. Now what does Oni mean? Lachma Anya. So it's very interesting to point out that in the Aramaic is already a translation. Lachma Anya, Lechem Oni. What does Oni mean? What are the two possibilities of Oni? Two possible interpretations.
Being poor or being afflicted.
Ani, or poor and afflicted, or...
Those are
one. There's another one.
Sad.
What?
Sad. No, like somebody who's not happy.
That's again the same theme from Ani, from Oni. There's another one. Anyone?
Not
enough.
That's
no, not enough.
Oh no, actually, it's avon, not
enough. That's lechem. Avonot. Avon. That's a good point. It's the same words. I think it might be a different word, same letters, which is worthwhile to investigate. From avon, from oni. Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
And then it's on the time, no?
What?
Is it the same source as?
Ona is a season, but that's okay. There's an easier one, a much more simple one. La'anot.
To answer.
Right.
Oh, I thought, and I
know something,
they tortured.
But that's Oni. But la'anot means to answer a question. Says the, read here, lechem, who says it over? He says, lechem she'onim alav dvarim. Says read here, I don't know what the read is. Okay, because what? Lachma anya? Lashon aniyat dvarim. It's not the bread of affliction, it's the bread of conversation. Right? It's a conversation. What? Right. It's a conversation piece, okay?
How to grab your read on the
first. Oh, that's why it's from the Gemara. I'm sorry, Gemara Pesachim says, Lashon Oni, Amar Shmuel, Lechem Oni, Lechem She'onim Alav Devarim. Shmuel said it. It's the Gemara. What is it? Why is it called Shmuel? That's what Gemara says. Very good, you know. And so that's, he says, very interesting, that's what the read, I don't know who the read is, but, whatever. I have this nifty Haggadah, which is, every time I read it, I get something new. This is the Torah Chaim Haggadah. Very highly recommended. Rabbi Yishaya Ditrani Hazaken. Rabbi Yishaya of Trani. Where was Trani? Yeah, where's Trani? Sounds Spanish? French? Trani, I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Probably I thought it could have been. What? Italian. Sounds Italian. Okay, Middle Ages, clearly. And he's going to Gemara, and he says, Lechem Anya, you thought it meant bread of affliction. It's not. It's the bread of conversation, first and foremost. Okay, second thing, obviously, another possible interpretation is, of course, Rashi says, Lechem Oni. Why is it the bread of poor people? Very interesting. He says that when you, it's based upon the Omer of the Asirit Ha'efa, right? How much would they bring? It's the amount of the, it was a quantity that an Ani would bring in his Korban Mincha. Right? So it was considered a quantity, the bread of the quantity that an Ani would bring, a poor person.
Which is also the amount of man that they got per day.
Correct, the amount of man that they would bring to per day. That was called Lechem Oni because it was Asirit Ha'efa, a tenth of an Efa, which is actually quite a bit of bread. But it, you know, it had nothing to do with, again, the kind of bread that they eat. Now, why would these Mefarshim not want to say that it was the kind of bread that they ate in Egypt?
Because they thought they didn't
eat it. Right, they didn't eat it in Egypt. So this comes to a very interesting discussion between the, quoted by the Avudraham. Okay, the Avudraham says, let me see if I can find it here. I'm just looking for it. The Orchot Chaim quotes the Ibn Ezra, who quotes Rav Yosef Azuvi, who said the following. He said, V'hayu ma'achilinot ha'lechem matzah. Right? The very famous psat that you all heard when you were kids. What do the Egyptians do? They fed them matzah, v'lo natnu lo v'olam chametz. They would never give them chametz. Why? V'hatam, the reason is, v'mnei she'eno mit'akil v'imheira k'chametz. Right? Matzah, as we all know, sits. V'yaspik v'imenu ma'at, and you can give less. V'chein hayu osin ha'mitzrim li'Yisrael. That's what the Egyptians would do to the Jewish people. Okay, there's only a few problems with the Ibn Ezra's quoting Rabbi Yosef the Azuvi, Rabbi Yosef Azuvi's explanation. What's the problem, first and foremost?
He just said that they didn't eat that bread in
Mitzrayim. Well, there's no evidence whatsoever. What? Daga, right? There's no evidence whatsoever that this is what the Egyptians fed them. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing, we all know that, of course, matzah never digests. Why does matzah not digest properly?
Bacteria.
What?
Because
it doesn't have bacteria?
Yeah, the bacteria's already starting to start the process of digestion.
Well, in, you think so? When you bake bread, you burn off all the bacteria in the yeast.
No, but there's a fermentation, which is just what happens in our stomach. We turn the bread to sourdough in our tummies.
I wouldn't know on that. Are you sure?
The enzymes,
no, with our bread. But that means that there's bacteria in the food. Now, in yogurt, there's still the bacteria that's healthy. But in bread, it all burns off when you bake it. You kill it. You kill the bacteria.
But it's the digestive system.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. Oh, it's already been broken down, you mean? Oh, interesting. Very interesting. I was thinking because we all eat matzah based on, it's very, very compact, very, very heavy carbohydrates. You'll notice, like, you know, it's all this very, very heavy white flour, and it's very hard to digest that way. So I recommend whole wheat matzah. What?
They didn't have white flour,
which is good to point out. They ate whole wheat pita, not regular. Right? You should just know that. Okay, there was no such thing as white flour until somebody figured out how to make that. That's a little pet peeve of ours. Okay, but imagine yourself, like, think back to, right, how did slavery work. You can't think of slavery in terms of you know, I have a slave that I feed every single day. I only give him matzah. Right? It wouldn't have worked that way. I think that, I don't know, like, does South Africa have, you do have a slavery history? That was a kind of silly question. America also has a slavery history. How did the slaves live? How did the American slaves live? What?
The slaves live on the property of their...
Who fed them? Meaning we cooked for them?
No, they cooked for themselves.
Yeah, of course.
They cook slaves.
Yeah.
What?
Slave cooks and slave workers.
Right, but don't...
The owners.
Exactly. Like, you can't think of slaves in terms of, like, you know, they, like, God forbid, like concentration camps. Right? Society could never function that way. The slaves had to take care of themselves, and they had to take care of us. Right, so I ate better, the master eats better, but I'm not going to make food for him. So what's he going to eat?
Whatever
he wants to make for himself.
Given the ingredients to make the food.
Correct. So now, would it have made sense for the Egyptians to say, you can only make matzah for yourself? Maybe. But it would make more sense for the Egyptians not to really care what the slave eats. I give you a certain amount, make it for yourself, and make sure you get to work on time.
Unless it's like part of like a psychological part of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
That like, you know, you as a slave, you can't eat regular bread. You have to eat the poor, this poor, tasteless bread. Not bread that's like the rich bread that we would eat. You know, whatever it looked like back then. But that there was
what was the difference between, good, bread. So what was the difference between, what is the difference between rich bread and poor bread? It's a very important thing to know. No.
And an oven.
Well, no. Because remember, you don't need yeast to make bread. You would make it yourself, just let the dough, or you just leave it. Right. So, and what would the Egyptian care if in the Jewish hovel, which I'm sure they lived in, so the one of the responsibilities of the woman who stays at home, and I assume that they did, and the women did women things, and the men did kind of men responsibilities.
No, they made bread.
And they switched it around. Okay, but...
You mean inside the home?
Inside the home or whatever. Gemara also says, remember the famous Gemara about the men going out and they were too tired and then the women would come with the food and all that? What?
Yeah, I'm right. Talking about it next
week. Oh, sorry. So then there are controversial, but only in Hebrew. There are contradictory sort of midrashim about that. Nonetheless, so they don't care what you did in your home. And the Jews, where did they live?
In Goshen.
Where the Egyptians? They lived in like the hovel, in like the slum. You know, and the Egyptians lived separately. So really, wouldn't care. What's the difference between poor bread and rich bread?
Well, nope. It wasn't a hovel to begin with.
Goshen?
No, not when they went down to Mizraim.
Right, but it's very. How long does it take for a posh neighborhood to become a slum?
Three teenagers.
And a little graffiti. Right, exactly. It doesn't take very long at all. Depends how you keep it up and you know your level of economic affluence. So, what's the difference between poor bread and rich bread? The quality of the wheat and dirt.
And what?
Dirt. What's black bread? Historically black bread?
No.
Oh yeah.
No.
Oh yeah.
Dirt.
Sure.
In the
of course.
Bread?
How would you get pure flour? What do you get pure? Like remember.
In Egypt had a problem. So
they. But the question is to what degree when you filter when you grind flour. Right? To what degree would you refine it? So if the more wealthy you were, the more refined the flour would be. And the poorer you were, and the less money you had, the more you would mix in other things with your flour in order to get the quantity that you needed in order to sustain yourself. Oh, yeah. Don't kid yourself. What? Sure, whatever. Whatever you could throw in. You know what I'm saying? And what they considered also barley and all the, like barley and all those whole like the whole grains that they would throw in. You know, it doesn't taste good. Just throw it in, whatever. That's the difference between rich man's bread and poor man's bread. So it's interesting. We consider rich and poor having to do with the amount of time that it bakes. It's not necessarily true. Right? Matzah is. I mean, I don't know how much does matzah cost here.
83 shekel.
Is it 83 shekel a kilo?
That's the cheapest you can find.
Oh, whoa. Really?
No, last night
they sold 1 cent a kilo.
Oh, it's a kilo. Oh, phew, I got scared. Because in America, it's about... Shmura, hand shmura.
It's cheaper here. Hand shmura. $16 a
pound. 16? 18.50 a pound. $20 a pound.
So a kilo?
It's half the price. Right, it's half the price.
Save yourself money by coming here.
Yeah, right. Oh, just by we wanted to know, do they let you do tours? Do they let you come and bake it? You just walk in.
Sit on the bench and shut the door. The head comes of the day when you can't even like stairs.
Oh, I'm going. Okay, fine. What? They smoke?
They let you take
some. They let you? Oh, I'm going to go. They let you go take some? It's a shack? I'm going to be nervous? Okay. But I got to go. See. Okay.
He has a matzo factory in his basement, and they let you, like, remember we went once, and he makes you clean your fingers and cut your nails, and he inspects your nails. Remember, I was, like, 18. I felt, like, very weird. No, I wasn't 18. I was a matzicha.
Is this in Beit Yaakov, in the old Beit Yaakov?
No. Okay. You know Ari Greenspan is from Ephrat?
No, okay.
He's very cool. He's matzahs. He's like, he found all the kosher wheat. He found he's involved in the trelet stuff.
Okay.
He's a very cool guy. Anyways, he built a house in Ephrat, and he built a matzah bakery in his basement.
People have pissed on kitchens.
I was led in Muncie. They made one out of a bus. There's a big controversy. Like in Muncie, you heard of this? That they made one out. They had, there was a school bus and nobody used it. So they turned it into a matzah bakery because they took the shell of the bus and made it into a matzah bakery. And so the health department came and shut them down. And of course, in Muncie, the Hasidim control the government. So of course, what do you know? The health department said it's got to be shut down. You have 2 weeks to finish. Okay. What?
Like that of a sukkah.
All right, the sukkah. It really happened. So that's why interesting. The Rashi says, what is lachma anya, lechem oni? It is not bread of affliction. Lachma anya, bread of conversation. Lechem oni, la'anot. Right? It is bread of poor people because of the quantity, but not the nature of the bread itself. Right? It's very interesting. Different than you are originally thought. As he quotes here, the footnote quotes, very interesting. He says, I'm Gruat Hashem. The Maharal says that asked on this divrei Rav Yosef Azuvi, right? He says the following. There is no evidence, the Maharal says, anywhere that the Egyptians fed our forefathers matzah. So that which your three-year-old, you know, second grade teacher taught you that the Egyptians gave you matzah, Maharal says it's not true. There's no, what?
No, that's because that they ate bread and then that was the whole strange thing that happened is that they didn't have, because obviously they had been eating bread, regular bread.
Right.
Because if they had all the time in Egypt been eating matzahs, it wouldn't have been a big deal that their bread didn't have time to rise, because it never would have left their bread to rise anyways.
Right.
So therefore, the Torah makes it sound like that what they ate leaving Mitzrayim was different to what they were usually eating. And therefore, we every year have to eat this different bread compared to what we usually eat.
Right. Okay, this is what the Ritva says. I'm just looking for you. The Ritva says, it's called lechem oni. Why? Because matzah is compact. Right? And it's together. Not like chametz, it's one big uga, one big little cake. Okay? And it's baked in that way that it's, I guess they call it missing, mitchaseret. And you can see the difference between rich bread that rises, right? Something that rises would be considered something more affluent than poor bread. So that's the third explanation. So that's why we call it lechem oni. Let's go back to the question of why do we say Abadim Hayinu, I'm sorry, Halach Ma'anya, keep confusing the two, in Aramit. Why is the whole thing said in Aramit? So it's very interesting. There's a number of different explanations for why we say it in Aramit. Okay? First and foremost, let me see. I saw some nice words here. See Pirush Kadmon. It says the following. Pirush Kadmon. Only on the Haggadah can you have 82 pages on Halach Ma'anya. Okay. Here we are. Okay. Very good. He says, "Kol babot agadah ne'amim b'lashon Ivri." The whole Haggadah is said in Ivri, except for this part. It is Aramaic. Why? L'fikis she'omer ha'agadah. When you say the Haggadah, b'tchilat babar b'shona magbihin ha'karash shasham matzo. You pick it up and you say, we talk about u'matchilin ledaber al inui hamatzo. The beginning of the Haggadah is the beginning of inui, of affliction. You don't pour the wine until you have manishtana. Why? What is wine a symbol of? Of chayrut, of freedom. Drink wine. Right? The cup is the kos yeshuot of salvation. We say first, we say in Aramit. The lamda gada teach you shekolzman shomrim baba shel aramit ein mozgin shamakos v'bishotah baba ein chozer matkir ki meone mitzrayim v'tichot ra'avon v'shibud. We begin the Haggadah by talking about affliction, by talking about the poverty, by talking about the slavery. So if you're going to start by talking about slavery, how do you do it? By speaking in the language of slavery. Aramit is the language of Galut, of the Gola. So in essence, what we should do, really, according to him, is... Right, this is the bread of... Maybe you should do that. Okay, everybody start the Seder, and if you're going to drive your kids nuts, they're going to go crazy on you, you pick it up and you say, right, this is the bread of affliction which our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt, and your children, who all speak Hebrew, will start and say, no! Halach ma'anya! Because, you know, they've learned something. So, and you say, well, why? No, I want to do it in English. And you can therefore point out, because they will not immediately notice that it's in Aramaic, right? You know, and then you'll point out, why not? Why should I do it in English? Because that's not what it says. Well, why do we say what it says? You know, who speaks Aramit? Nobody speaks Aramit. Okay, so says the Kadmon, I don't know who that is, says that because the reason why it begins in Aramit is because the whole night of Pesach is a night of transformation. May Avdut L'Cheirut. So the first thing you do, it's so interesting how he sees it, the conversation begins a conversation of Avdut, and then immediately transforms into Manishtana. Right, the language of whom?
A free children.
What?
A free people.
A free people.
Say why it's different.
Well, I wouldn't say that. Who can speak in their own language? Right, which is very, very interesting. And also, I want to connect that to the Megillah, Megillat Esther. One of the things that you notice that Mordechai insisted on, right, in the beginning, Ahasuerus sent out his letters in 127 languages. But at the end, when Mordechai and Esther send it out, they send it out to 127 languages. Ve'el ha-Yehudim bil shonam. And he also sent that out in Hebrew. Meaning, a free people has a language. A free people communicates, the Jewish people ideally communicate in Hebrew. When the Jewish people don't communicate in Hebrew, that tells us that we're missing something. Halach ma'anya. That's one explanation I think is a very beautiful, very powerful reason to start in a different language. Maybe I'll do that this year. I'm going to do that. I'm going to start in English and drive my kids crazy. No! Okay, fine.
You could really say, I mean, a lot of times in Judaism, if it, tell me if I'm wrong, if it means more to you and you understand it and it's going to transmit more information, then you could say all of it in English if you have to.
There are only very few things that you can't say. In fact, people... What?
Other than Pesach Matzah.
You say that also in Hebrew. You say it in English. I mean, you can say it in any language you want. Say it for Yitzhak Mitzrayim. The only thing, ironically, you cannot say is what's something called Mikra Bikurim. What's Mikra Bikurim? No, Mikra Bikurim, not Vidoy Maser. Vidoy Maser, Mikra Bikurim. What do you say, ironically? Arami Aved Avi, which is part of the Haggadah, it's in Hebrew, but only when you're bringing the Bikurim, because it says you have to say this text.
Right.
But mostly, I mean, you're talking about the Chazal say you could say Shema in Hebrew, in English. Right, things that are, you could say Shmona Esrei in English. Yeah.
With a Baal Tshuva for a meal.
Yeah.
And he was a Kohen, my friend, so he wanted to give him the honor of benching.
Right.
So he said, I could read Hebrew, but I don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he said that, but it's interesting because he could read Hebrew. So he said, so say it in English.
Right.
And he was like Mevarech at the table with like a whole kila of men in English.
Right.
And he was like...
Isn't it really ironic? Yeah, but God forbid that if we would ever do that, because we wouldn't feel firm enough to do that.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Oh, no, I would never do that. No. You know, I got to do it in Hebrew. You know, we train Baalei Tshuva that they have to speak in Hebrew. They have to dive in Hebrew, and they have no idea what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as opposed to learning to pray in English. What?
Also, in American second grade, I had no clue what I was saying either.
Right.
And then eventually it clicks. Like,
one hopes.
American students have no idea what they're saying either.
No idea. None whatsoever.
It's so sad, because the truth is, you should know what you're saying.
Of course.
In art school, I'll never forget, one of my very firm teachers, also once in high school, like there was, she said to me, and we didn't know what it meant, she said, girls, there is art school today. There is no excuse not to know what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
I remember she was like, and she's not the type of person to walk around with an art school. Yeah. And I was like, I still remember it, obviously. She was like,
what's your problem?
Consider if you don't understand, like, you know, get with it.
Right. It's true. Or daven in English, but nobody would feel comfortable saying, mm-hmm. speaking to God in English, God forbid. And saying what you want and meaning it. What?
She might not understand.
She might not understand.
That's not an art scroll, I can promise you that.
Which brings me to my second explanation of why we speak in Aramaic. Says the Orchot Chaim, Kadeshi Avinu Anashim V'Hataf. So women and children would understand. Well, why women and children? Because in his day, obviously, people did not understand Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic. The spoken language was whatever. So meaning, at least at the very beginning, the Haggadah must be accessible. So now we speak in Hebrew, so maybe there's a certain irony in the sense that if you'd ask our children, what does this mean? Ha'alach ma'anya de'achalua v'tana de'ara de'mitzrayim. I have no idea. But if you would say, ze lechem aniyut she'achalu avoteinu be'eretz mitzrayim, that I understand. You know, so the irony is that there's a certain, you know, the Haggadah was originally written in a language that people who didn't understand would understand. And now we specifically say it in that language so that people
mm-hmm. right.
mm-hmm. don't understand.
To remember where you came from. I mean, there is that element of it, but even going back to what you said originally about the ideal saying of the Haggadah being in Eretz Yisrael, it wasn't written in Eretz Yisrael.
Uh-huh.
the ideal thing is that the whole point of remembering Mitzrayim is remembering that we came out of Galut. And if you're in Eretz Yisrael and saying part of the Haggadah in the language of Aramaic, then you're remembering even a more recent Galut that you came out of, not just the Galut of Mitzrayim, and it becomes a much more tangible, real thing, the concept of going from Galut to Chesed.
Again, but that's true. I agree with you, but that's original. That's the first reason. Here we're talking about a different reason. They did so people would understand it. They specifically said, listen, you're not going to, like you said, you're not going to understand the rest of it. And remember also, we were dealing, Chazal dealt very much with an illiterate society like Shimon Asrei. They didn't even know Shimon Asrei, and they would listen to the Chazan recite the Shimon Asrei, and they would, you know, whatever he thought, whatever his kavanot were, you know, then that's, what?
The Yamed?
The Yamed, right. And, but that was enough for them. So then, but they at least felt they needed something, they had to have something of the Haggadah that they would be able to, you know, understand that this is something that the children should understand. Again, it's an issue of accessibility, the importance of the notion of accessibility in the Haggadah. So that it's, others say the following. Yeah.
You also, I mean, here it says, you say, whoever wants to join me, come and join me.
Right.
You say it in Hebrew, the people that you're calling to are not going to understand
right.
The language of the place.
Correct. Very good. So you're saying that it reflects the end, that because you're making it more accessible to strangers.
To strangers.
Yeah, very good.
To people that
absolutely.
Don't have homes. To
absolutely.
To uneducated people that wouldn't necessarily know Hebrew. Mm-hmm.
Others say the following is very interesting. Where was the Haggadah written? It's a very interesting discussion of when the Haggadah was instituted. So it brings up this very interesting discussion. Most Mefarshim, or some Mefarshim, suggest that most of the Haggadah is really drashot. I mean, we know that most of the Haggadah is drashot, extrapolating of Psukim. It's really from the Midrash. So a lot of it was written in the times of the Tanaim. But the vast majority of it, you know, even the Manish Tana, you'll find the four questions appear in the Mishnah. Right, and by the way, this very, very, very deep, very powerful idea that to understand and communicate that this ritual that we do, this is one of the really, really few rituals that goes back all the way back to the time of the Beit HaMikdash. That in this man of the Beit HaMikdash, they were doing this thing. They were Mesaper Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's important to realize, it says, when we go into this, Masa, Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Chaim, you know, these are Tanaim. Who were sitting, you know, they lived in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, Rabbi Kiva, they even saw its destruction. But during the time, they said, Hillel said, Pesach Matzah U'Maor. These are people who are like, you know, and we're doing the same thing. Okay? Except, when it came to Bavel, they added on this idea of Halach Ma'anya Di'achalu Apatana. Because it wouldn't make sense for Rabbi Akiva sitting in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Beit HaMikdash to say, Hashata al Avdei Lashana Habab Arad Yisrael. So when they got to Bavel, the Rabbanim of Bavel added on in Aramaic, in their language, this Halach Ma'anya, Hashta Abdei Lashana Habab Arad Yisrael.
That's a very important question. So we have the right to check it. Now that we're sitting in Israel, no one understands this Aramaic anyway. We're sitting here, we're not planning to go anywhere next year.
God willing, right?
So
dump it.
You added it. No, it's irrelevant.
Okay, I'm going to add a heretical question.
We're never from enough, right? So just put this.
You raise just another entirely different shiur. That's a very, very important question that I'll just tell you something I personally struggle with that I shared with a rabbi of mine this week. I said to him the following. I said, one of the things that you must do in order to be yotze all of the eating and the drinking that you do on the night of the Seder is you have to lean, okay? We all lean to the left, okay? Does anybody know any king, president, prime minister, dictator, you what have you, of any country that leans to the left when he eats? Or
no,
she, I'm sorry, when she eats. No.
Sorry, I say like my optimal right. Seder would be in our basement with all of the...
Oh, on those couches?
And all of our couches. And that's what they actually did.
They land on a couch.
They sat on a couch.
And by the way, I just tried to imagine to myself, how do they do it? I mean, just like, what do you do with your hands? Is there somebody feeding you?
They were
like,
leaning, when they said leaning,
good.
Like, you know, imagine those like...
No, to lean on my couch with the little thing right over there, right? With their right hand. It just doesn't seem comfortable.
It's easier to eat.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay,
so, but here we have a thing that clearly was envisioned at a time when people clearly were doing that. It was a symbol of the monarchy of the Malchut.
Right.
And it doesn't apply today.
Right.
So what do you do? So his answer to me was, And he felt that the Chazal wanted to envision, you would envision that you were going out of Egypt. And not that you're a king the way kings are today, but the kings are the way kings were in the time of Mitzrayim. That's when you're going out. But he said, even if you don't like that answer, tough. You're still stuck with it. Because we are, a lot of who we are, the identity of who we have, is the way that our tradition was handed down to us. So, Halach Ma'anya is still part of who we are. Now, what I want to, I guess I'll conclude with this. It raises a very interesting, very, very interesting question. There's also another explanation of why we do it in Aramaic. Another thing we do in Aramaic is because, interestingly enough, the Malachim don't understand Aramaic. Everyone knows we say Kaddish in Aramaic. The things that one of the languages you're not allowed to daven in is Aramaic, the Gemara says, because the angels can't bring your prayers to God because they don't understand Aramaic. The Gemara says they don't understand Aramaic.
Why in a language they don't understand?
Because it's only us. We're reciting, we are being Mekadosh Hashem Hashem. Now, so why would we not want to say it in Aramaic? Why would we say it in Aramaic? Because if we say Halach Ma'anya, what we're doing is we're reinforcing the idea that Hashem is saying, oh, you see, the Malachim would say, see how bad they are, they shouldn't be, look where they are, they're in the exile, they don't deserve to be redeemed. So in order to prevent the angels from being Mekatreg, from accusing us to God, we say Halach Ma'anya in Aramaic. Da'achalu, and now we're in Babel. So I think it raises a very interesting question of the notion of the Seder that we celebrate, that we're going to celebrate in Eretz Yisrael. I'm wrapping it up. I gotcha. That in Eretz Yisrael is a sort of neither here nor there kind of we're not here, we're not there. We're in Eretz Yisrael, but on the other hand, we're still reciting the Halach Ma'anya in Aramaic, in Aramaic. We're sitting at the Seder in Hebrew with our children, thank God. In the promised land, in you know, Hashana Habab, Arad Yisrael, I said it last year. This year we're in Arad Yisrael, but I'm staying in Aramaic. And I'm still having that Fashlugana Korech with the matzah, and you know, I'm waiting for my shawarma. You know what I'm saying? I'm waiting for my shawarma. You know, I'm sure David is waiting for his shawarma, but you know, we're all waiting for the Korban Pesach. And that, you know, how are we supposed to celebrate? And this is a question that's really good to ask and really good to discuss. How are we supposed to celebrate Chirut in a time of Chirut, in a time when we have our language, when we have our Eretz, but we're still Avdim. We're still Avdim. It's a great fodder for conversation on Lel HaPesach. Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks.